Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to have a very interesting, dual conversation, I guess one might say, with two men I admire greatly. One is Vice Admiral William Dean Lee, United States Coast Guard retired. The other is Commander Rob Green, United States Navy, active duty, and the author of a terrific book of really tremendous importance, Defending the Constitution Behind Enemy Lines. They have jointly collaborated on the piece that is the subject of today's conversation. It's entitled The Institution or the Constitution, and it talks about the difficulties our government has in coming to grips with some of those issues that cross both of those subjects, and the tendency to sort of circle the wagons in defense of the institution rather than pursuing what the Constitution requires. Gentlemen, it's good to have you both with us. Thank you for taking some time to talk to us here at Securing America.
Good to be with us.
I want to start, Admiral, if I may, just very briefly. This is not the topic that we asked you to speak to, but I can't help myself. You being a man with considerable experience in not only the Coast Guard, but in the Coast Guard's Atlantic area of operations. Talk to me what we should think at the moment about what went down in Baltimore Harbor last week and its knock-on effects, sir.
Well, I don't want to prescribe what you ought to think. I mean, let's wait till the facts come out. We've got the Coast Guard folks, the NTSB is on scene, and they're working in collaboration to figure this out. I don't want to second guess them. I've never been one of those retired flags that wants to get on TV or radio and make their job harder when I don't have nearly as many facts to speak from as they do. Over.
Well, I appreciate that. Understood. I'm going to have to say anxious to get your thoughts when we know more, and we'll be back to you about that. We did do, under the auspices of the Committee on the Present Danger China, of which our Center for Security Policy is an important co-sponsor, a webinar on Friday on the subject, and I'll make sure that you both have a copy of that. You can find it, folks, at presentdangerchina.org. I hope you'll subscribe to all of these webinars, but there's some very interesting insights, I think, into what we do know at this point, what we have reason to believe is relevant to the investigation, and we'll be very anxious to see how it all turns out. But this is a major problem, and Admiral, I was just saying to you off air that I was, for one, having driven by that port on countless occasions, did not fully appreciate how vital it is to both our national security as well as our commercial and economic well-being as well. So again, we'll be back to you about all of that. But let's turn to the topic of the moment, and that is your analysis of what has befallen not just really the nation, but specifically the United States military in the aftermath of the COVID pandemic. And Rob, as I say, your book speaks powerfully to some of the effects of policy decisions, including mandating jabs to all military personnel and essentially precluding them from having the opportunity to seek waivers on religious grounds, among others. Set the stage for this conversation, if you would, a little bit, and then we'll get into your article.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you very much for the opportunity to speak on this. So the book, we cover at the strategic level what happened and analyzed it in light of what the founding fathers went through in fighting tyranny, and then comparing that with what individuals were doing in fighting for their own constitutional rights and their own statutory rights. We had the government mandating a shot that was rushed through. It was experimental in nature. It was under statutory laws as an experimental product, and yet was mandated in violation of those laws. And then when folks had religious objections to those, the First Amendment rights of the individual were completely trampled by the Department of Defense. And so that is the context of the book. And we share human interest stories from individuals in the military who stood on their constitutional statutory rights and then were subsequently harmed by those policies. What that focus was all about was sort of the individual and the individual fight sort of at the strategic level. What we have done recently is taken a look at this, and I am very grateful for the Admiral's guidance. He's been there since the beginning as a person for many of us still in uniform to go to for mentorship and for guidance. And he helped us to see this too from the perspective of the highest ranking leaders all the way down to the mid-level leaders in the military who operated in good faith, who did the best they could with the information that they had, and then went forward with what they were told, trusting in their leadership. You know, we heard the mantra safe and effective, hammered home. And in the very beginning, if you are very trusting of those above you, as ideally you should be able to be, then it would make sense for someone operating in good faith, trying to take care of their force, to do everything they can to keep their force healthy. And so that's the context in which we have recently written an article about this and focused on those operating in good faith and how protecting at this point in the aftermath of it, protecting the institution is actually going to do detriment to the oath to the Constitution in which individual rights are supposed to have primacy.
Admiral, I wanted to get your take on this. You've obviously had service at the highest ranks of the United States Coast Guard, and I understand that you have a certain sympathy for those in leadership who made the call that getting these jabs mandated was sensible early on, and yet it became clear over time that that was ill-advised. Walk us through your thought process on all of this, if you would, sir.
I'd be glad to. So, you know, putting myself back in the shoes of the position that I used to have, you know, this was unprecedented, this pandemic, in terms of the impact that it was having on the readiness of the fleet. And so my job as an operational commander, it was no different than that of any other operational commander for any service, and that's to maintain a ready force so that we can deploy. It's even more so for us in the Coast Guard in that we've got a 7x24-hour mission we do whether we're at war or not. We're the first responders on the high seas. And so it's incredibly important that we be able to launch when the call comes in. And so had I been in the position that my predecessors or successors were at the same time, I would have made the same conclusions they did and probably did the same thing in the same way. However, break, that was based on trust. Trust that what the medical folks were telling us was true. And trust that they weren't walking on the constitutional rights of any members of any faith who had religious reasons for not wanting to take the vaccine. Now, Rob and I are both men of faith. He's a Catholic. I'm a Protestant. I didn't see any compelling reason that I shouldn't, and I took it. I'm not anti-vaccine, but I will tell you this. I am absolutely pro-Constitution, and I will stand on Rob's right or any other member's right to do what their conscience tells them to do. And that's where I entered the fight. And so where I find fault with leadership in this whole ordeal occurred.
Let me ask you to break for just a second. I want to get to that, and we are out of time to do it okay. On this side of the break. We'll take a short one and we'll be right back with more to find out where you find fault with the serving leadership today. And thank you for your extraordinary forthrightness and courage in bringing that to the fore. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps commander responsible for that terrorist group's operations in and from Syria and Lebanon was killed yesterday in a consular building in Damascus. Israel has not taken responsibility but is presumed to have pulled off the airstrike that killed Mohammad Reza Zahidi and six other jihadists. The UN Security Council will convene this afternoon to denounce that attack on a diplomatic compound, but its use by Iranian terrorists is a fresh reminder of the evil nature of the enemy Israel confronts, as do we. The IRGC and its proxies also routinely use hospitals, schools, and mosques as arsenals, headquarters, and staging sites for attacks, typically against Israeli civilians. While Israel strives to minimize casualties among non-combatants, in a war for its very survival, the Jewish state cannot allow its mortal enemies diabolically to use such sites as sanctuaries. This is Frank Afton.
We're back, and we have a duet going here with Vice Admiral William Dean Lee, United States Coast Guard retired, and Commander Rob Green, United States Navy, an active duty serviceman, who has written a very important book on the subject we're talking about, and that is Defending the Constitution Behind Enemy Lines, about Rob Green's experience and that of an awful lot of other serving men and women in uniform. And indeed some who are no longer serving, involuntarily separated from the service over their reluctance to take the, it's now very clear, inadequately tested so-called vaccine for COVID-19. And Admiral, you were just teeing up brilliantly the where you find fault with the current leadership of the United States military in connection with this COVID business. Over to you, sir.
So to be clear, I don't know if I find fault with current leadership, but I found fault with the leadership in place at the time, where we had already administered the vaccine to 97% of the force. And now, and we did all that based on good faith that the vaccine would work. And now we've already found out that A, it did not work. It didn't prevent the acquisition of the virus, nor did it prevent the spread of it. And then you had other noted doctors and scientists from the elite institutions that were pushing back on this and getting canceled, and we still got the pedal to the metal, discharging officers and enlisted for standing their ground on what they considered their constitutional rights. And then Rob brings in the great point here that we're pushing upon them a vaccine that's not approved. And if you when I got further educated on how that whole process worked, I came to the conclusion that we needed to take a strategic pause. The government needed to take a pause and let's evaluate this. Do no further harm, and let's get this right. Else, we're going to lose the trust and confidence of the troops that serve.
Well, and it turns out lose a lot of troops as well.
Exactly.
Rob, to your point, and this is so critical, and I think largely unknown, frankly, the vaccinations that were being given to the troops were not those that had been approved on an emergency use authorization basis. What was it?
Yeah, so there were two products, essentially, one that went through some testing initially to receive the emergency use authorization. And then the FDA approved a separate product based on those tests that once the law says that once that that second product has actually achieved full licensure by the FDA, the previous product is supposed to be removed from the market. But what ended up happening with billions and billions of these shots on the shelves, Pfizer came out and said, we're not going to make any of the new product that's got the full licensure. We're going to get through the product that's already out there. And the DOD, you know, says, okay, well, we're going to mandate this product based on the licensure for the product that we already have on the shelves. So it was a little bit of a bait and switch is essentially what was happening.
But the bait and switch, the point of this particular conversation is it was illegal what they did, is it not?
It was illegal. It violated Title 21 law. And then, of course, once folks had religious objections, they violated Title 21 and Title 42. That's supposed to protect them. And of course, the First Amendment of the Constitution, which is the highest law of the land, they violated that as well. So we have serious issues.
When you gentlemen have joined forces for the purposes of defending the Constitution, and I want to just say, as somebody who had done it myself, how much I prize the fact that you have both held to your oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. This really raises the question as to at what point must there be, you know, accountability so that we don't find ourselves making similar kinds of mistakes in the future. And Admiral, maybe I could start with you on this because, among other things, you manned up to help cadets at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy who were finding themselves in the crosshairs, if I could use that expression, because they did exactly what you said was their right to do under the Constitution. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, and more generally about accountability.
Well, insofar as accountability is concerned on this matter, what I'm asking, and what you know, Rob wrote the preponderance of that paper that he so kindly allowed me to attach my name to. I mean, he did the heavy lifting on that, but the little bit that I contributed was really in the last paragraph or two, where I said, look, what we need to do, we owe due diligence to the troops, to the institution. If we want to maintain, rebuild trust in the members that serve, we need to go back and hot wash this thing. We need to run every process that we ever, you know, used. We need to look at everything we did, every decision we made, and determine whether it was the best decision or not. And then so that we can learn from those lessons and make sure that we don't do the same thing over again the next time we have a pandemic of this sort. Because it's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when. Let's don't repeat our past mistakes. That's all I'm asking them to do. I'm not looking for anybody's head on a platter. I just want us to do the right thing here. Over.
Rob, to you, you are continuing to serve. You're continuing, I'm sure, to watch some of this playing out in your service, the United States Navy, as well as others among the services. Speak to the issue of accountability, as well as doing the due diligence, the hot wash, as the Admiral put it, to make sure that we don't repeat these mistakes in the future, at perhaps even greater cost down the road.
Yeah, thank you. And I think Admiral Lee undersells his contributions a little bit. He has been there since the beginning, even for me personally, as well as a lot of people, to help guide a lot of my thought on this. And so I have taken a pretty aggressive approach in fighting. Once I realized that laws were being broken and our leadership were ignoring us. And I mean, if you read my book in chapter 15, I describe so many of the horrible ways that people were harmed, not just by the vaccine itself and physical injuries, but also through moral injury and the lack of trust. There were suicides that resulted. These policies horrifically harmed our service members in so many ways. And so I fought this with incredible aggression, I guess is the only way that you could say that.
I would add with incredible courage as well, because as an active duty serving individual, I don't need to tell either of you what the risks are.
Thank you for that. I just feel like it was doing my duty because I have a responsibility as the lowest level of senior officer there is, I have a responsibility for these people that are not being taken care of. And our leadership was ignoring us. Well, Admiral Lee was not ignoring me when I brought things to him, and he was giving me a great advice, sage advice. And that was the result, I think, of this particular article that we wrote at Real Clear Defense. It was helping me understand that I can fight this with aggression, but the number of villains in this fight are incredibly small. The number of people who operate in good faith, that is a huge number. And that's the folks that we need to reach. And so the aggression needs to be reserved for those at the highest levels who knew better, with the folks that we were sending our reports to and our data to that ignored us. That's where the aggression resides.
Thank you for bringing to bear that aggression in the best sense of the word skillfully. Malie, thank you for your mentoring of outstanding men in uniform and women like Rob Green. We so appreciate you both and look forward to further conversations about all of this made possible by our Center for Security Policy. I hope people will take a look at supporting our work here at Securing America. It's the place to go is centerforsecuritypolicy.org. Thank you, gentlemen. Both come back soon if you would. In the meantime, God bless you and your work. Keep it up. We'll be right back, sir.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and I'm always delighted to be able to say we are joined by Kenneth Raposa. He is a man that I've come to admire over the years for his reporting, for among other outfits, the Wall Street Journal, his essays and op-eds in a whole variety of other places, including the Daily Caller, and we came across one there that we want to talk to him about specifically. He is these days an industry analyst with a terrific coalition that we're happy to partner with on many occasions with our Committee on the Present Danger China. It's called the Coalition for a Prosperous America, and it's done indispensable work, including with our mutual friend Roger Robinson, on these issues involving our financial underwriting of our most dangerous, indeed, I would argue, mortal enemy, the Chinese Communist Party. Ken Raposa is intimately involved in that CPA work, and we're delighted always to have a chance to pick his brain. Welcome, sir. Good to have you back.
Thanks for having me on.
So you've done a piece, as I mentioned, for the Daily Caller recently, in which you talked about Mexico as becoming China's mini-me, which is a wonderful way of putting it. Describe what you mean by that and what we should be concerned about.
Sure. Well, since the beginning of the Trump era trade war, the Section 301 tariffs, and then, of course, after that, the COVID lockdowns that really changed the way we ship things out of Asia and the price of shipping that became very inflationary for companies, they decided we're going to leave China because of geopolitical risk and costs. Ford, for example, was one company that told their partners in Asia and China, hey, we can't deal with these prices, we cannot, with shipping, we cannot deal with the geopolitical risk. We don't know where Washington's going to be tomorrow on an issue with trading with China. So why don't you set up shop in Mexico? So companies like that did. This was a battery company, I believe, that set up there. Oh, no, it was an auto parts company. I can't think of the name of it, but it was an auto parts company. It's in the Daily Caller op-ed I did. And they set up shop in China. They're not the only ones. Of course, they were enticed by Ford to do that.
The Chinese company set up shop in Mexico, I think.
Yeah, exactly. They were enticed to do so by Ford, right? So Ford called them to come there. And so now, obviously, you know, if you and I, you know, it's just pure, you know, it's common sense, right? If you and I have a business in China, we're two Chinese guys. We've been doing business with XYZ Corp in the United States for 20 years. Now there's a problem with the relationship. I don't want to lose that. It's too bad I'm going to lose my workers, because that's very important to China. China wants that full employment. But at least I'm not going to lose my market, and I'm not going to lose my business. And I'm going to set up shop in Mexico to make that happen. And that's what's happening now. So we're seeing a lot of that concept of reshoring, which is moving to Mexico. Mexico is now our number one source of imports, surpassing China last year. And it's moving to Mexico now. And a lot of that is China. China trade to Mexico is up 60% January this year compared to last year. China is becoming a big supplier to Mexico, and they're setting up shop in Mexico. They're investing in Mexico. And they're not investing in Mexico, Frank, to sell to Mexico. They're investing in Mexico to make and sell here. So right. There's going to be more of a flood of Mexican-made goods into the United States.
So, but this basically, I guess, comes down to, you know, an end run using the sort of son of NAFTA agreements that Donald Trump proudly, you know, reminds us he helped engineer. But it's still basically China, is it not, that is benefiting principally from this kind of trade. And the brand of Mexico, or imported from Mexico, or made in Mexico, is a bit of a subterfuge.
Well, with China and Mexico, the Chinese multinationals are leaving China. They're setting up shop in Mexico because they know they can get access to the United States duty-free. They cannot do that in China because we have tariffs, and because they have dumping tariffs and all these other geopolitical risks that are now coming, still in place with Biden. If Trump wins, they naturally assume this is going to get worse. But that's not just China that's coming to Mexico, of course. It's also the Japanese that are going, setting up shop in Mexico. The Koreans are setting up shop in Mexico. The Germans are setting up shop in Mexico. So NAFTA, which was, of course, originally designed to be a free trade agreement with Mexico to make Mexico rise up and stop being a IMF basket case nation, of which it was in the 90s. Now it is not, thanks to this market here in the United States, the most coveted market in the world, the place everyone wants to sell to. And they're all going to Mexico. And now Mexico is opening its doors to these countries because foreign direct investment in Mexico is ballooning like never before, especially in states like Nuevo León. And we have a free trade agreement essentially now with German multinationals, which we don't have a free trade agreement with Germany. We don't have a free trade agreement with the Japanese. We do with the Koreans. We don't have one with the Japanese. We don't have one with the Germans. But they can set up shop here and make BMWs and sell them in the United States for duty-free under NAFTA. So this is a big problem. Yes, correct. Correct. It's going to be a problem.
So we're being taken advantage of. And this is under the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, USCMA. Let me just say, this is just one of the things that's a little worrying about south of the border. We've got, of course, the guys coming across that border. We've got the fentanyl that's being similarly manufactured there for the Chinese. But in addition to that, Ken, and you've been following this for much of your career, Mexico is a newcomer to the so-called BRICS team, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa group initially. Give us an update on this, if you would, given your extensive experience in the financial sector. Are we now seeing the inevitable emergence?
Well, Mexico has said that the language that Mexico uses is that they're observing the BRICS, currency. They're observing the trend of the BRICS. And
talk us through the implications,
you know, what they're thinking about, you know, politically and economically for each other, correct? But they have not said that we're going to become part of the BRICS like the Egyptians have over recent months, right? So they have never said that. And I think that, that they know that they can't say that because the United States would come knocking on the door and saying, what's this all about? You know, we can't have a NAFTA too. We can't have a USMCA if you're going to become part of BRICS. I mean, it's bad enough as it is, as I said earlier, that NAFTA is now becoming a free trade agreement with any multinational that wants to set up shop there. We don't have that reciprocal agreement with those countries. So, as far as the BRICS go, let's not forget what the BRICS were originally set up to be, right? So, of course, this became a term that Goldman Sachs used to define these countries, which were the biggest markets, the biggest economies of their region. Brazil, the biggest in Latin America, South Africa, the healthiest and strongest economy at the time of African continent. Now it might be Nigeria might surpass it now, and South Africa is a political mess. And the idea there was too, Frank, as you may recall, was let's have it so that we use our central bank reserves to help each other in a crisis. So we don't have to anymore rely on the IMF. Or let's say we want to build a dam somewhere. We don't have to worry about the World Bank funding it and saying they're not going to fund it because there's a fish over there that they want to protect or something like that. And that's going to hurt us economically because that's going to be cheap energy for us. Okay. So let's all fund it ourselves. So that was always the concept. That was the original concept of the BRICS. Now the idea is that maybe we can make an alternative to the dollar, right? An alternative to the SWIFT system. I think that's going to slowly happen. That's going to be something that the trend line is pointing in that direction. But to unseat the dollar as the world reserve currency, I don't see that happening anytime soon, mostly because we are the deepest securities market in the world. This is where everybody, you and I can't buy $100 billion worth of Brazilian bonds tomorrow. We can't, but we can buy $100 billion worth of treasury bonds. We can do that, but we can't do $100 billion worth of Brazil bonds. We certainly can't buy $100 billion worth of South African bonds. So that's the reason why the United States dollar is so powerful. And of course, again, as I said earlier, where does Frank and Ken Incorporated setting up in Estonia, where do we want to sell our widget to? Latvians, the Lithuanians, the Russians? No, we want to sell it to the United States. So as long as everybody wants to keep selling here, as long as we are the market of first and last resort, and as long as we have the biggest securities market, that will protect. But the dollar is in trouble, Frank, as you know, you talk about this all the time, is because of the political weaponization of the dollar. And that's the biggest risk to the dollar and how companies are going to move away from it.
And just the endless printing of more of them as well. Ken, just very quickly on that particular point, I know you've been tracking with CPA and others this phenomenon of the central bank digital currency. We've got 45 seconds. Where does that stand with respect to the dollar at the moment?
I would say that the central bank digital currency, right, Frank, is always a work in progress, right? We hear about this all the time, and it becomes more of an issue of, you know, sort of more of a foreign intrigue thing, because we all know that the central bank digital currency is going to be sold to us as a way to control inflation because it's a programmable currency. So now we don't have to worry about inflation anymore. If you can program what you can spend it on and how much you can spend. I don't see that happening anytime soon, and I hope it doesn't happen. I don't think anybody wants it. Let's hope it doesn't happen.
I don't think so either. I know we don't, that's for sure. Our Center for Security Policy and our work with the Sovereignty Coalition on the whole World Health Organization global governance gambit, I'm sure you're aware, Ken, we've got a problem with a sort of central, whatever the Chinese are calling it, the social credit system. It'll be in spades with that CBDC. That and more to come. Thanks so much for joining us. Ken, we'll talk with you again soon, my friend. Come back for more. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps commander responsible for that terrorist group's operations in and from Syria and Lebanon was killed yesterday in a consular building in Damascus. Israel has not taken responsibility but is presumed to have pulled off the airstrike that killed Mohammad Reza Zahidi and six other jihadists. The UN Security Council will convene this afternoon to denounce that attack on a diplomatic compound, but its use by Iranian terrorists is a fresh reminder of the evil nature of the enemy Israel confronts, as do we. The IRGC and its proxies also routinely use hospitals, schools, and mosques as arsenals, headquarters, and staging sites for attacks, typically against Israeli civilians. While Israel strives to minimize casualties among non-combatants, in a war for its very survival, the Jewish state cannot allow its mortal enemies diabolically to use such sites as sanctuaries. This is Frank Afton.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to Rabbi Pesach Wilicki, a star of stage and screen now, as it happens, a man who has his own television program on our favorite television network, Real America's Voice. You can find it there at 3 p.m. on Sundays. It's entitled Eyes on Israel, and it's just one of the myriad platforms that our friend Pesach is now utilizing. To very considerable effect, notably Israel 365 News, as well as his own podcast, Shoulder to Shoulder. And it's a very important time for a man of his abilities to be speaking truthfully about matters that are directly relevant, of course, to his adopted homeland of Israel, but also, I believe, to the United States and its vital interests as well. Rabbi, it's great to have you back with us. Welcome and congratulations on the new show. I gather there was a guest over the weekend, this weekend, that I think our audience would be familiar with.
Yes, Frank Gaffney. How about was on that? There speaking about the infiltration of the Muslim Brotherhood into the United States. Something that needs to be amplified now that Israel is fighting the Muslim Brotherhood. And let's all remember that Hamas is the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yes, it is.
So thank you for that appearance. It was great.
Well, thank you. And it's great to have
your well wishes on the new show.
It's great to have a home-to-home relationship here. Rabbi, I wanted to spend a few minutes talking with you about a very disturbing report that the Jewish News Syndicate, I think, picked up from some other Israeli reporters. It's to the effect that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a man that I have not had terribly high regard for, I must confess, General C.Q. Brown, told his Israeli counterpart last week that, we're going to be cutting back on the provision of arms to Israel. They've subsequently tried to clarify there's been no change of policy, but he let it slip that there are weapons that we don't want Israel to have, and those will not be provided. But more to the point, he indicated that as an alternative to what Israel has planned and briefed the Americans on last week about their operation coming up in Rafah, what the United States thinks needs to happen is to have a joint U.S.-Israel command operation there in Rafah that would oversee the strikes that the Israeli military presumably and maybe some American personnel would engage in. I can think of a dozen reasons that this is a very bad idea. What are your thoughts, sir?
Well, I'm speaking now as an Israeli, as someone whose children are fighting in Gaza and someone who's lived in Israel for 30 years, although I am also a patriotic American. And I know some people view that as a contradiction, but, I can love my mother and love my father. I can have strong feelings about two nations. But this is a as you say, this is a terrible idea. Most importantly, we have to pull back the camera and ask the question, why the United States is suggesting this? Because their official reason for suggesting it is that they don't want to see the amount of civilian casualties, the humanitarian crisis, as they call it, as was seen in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. But the problem is that the idea that there's been excessive civilian casualties in this conflict is itself a blood libel. It's actually false. And let me just walk through that very quickly, because it's critical to understanding what the U.S. is doing. Very, very briefly, even if we take the official number of civilian casualties at face value, which is put out by Hamas, they run the Gazan Health Ministry, which is a laughable concept. Even if we take their numbers completely at face value, which is absurd on its face that we should do so, and it's already been debunked by statisticians who have analyzed the numbers, but even taking it at face value, it produces a 1.4 to 1 civilian to combatant casualty ratio, which already would be by far the lowest of any urban combat situation in history, prompting people like John Spencer, who is the head of urban warfare at West Point, to write multiple articles in Newsweek and elsewhere, basically saying that no army in history has ever protected civilians more effectively than the Israeli army. Now, assuming that...
Could I just interrupt you on that point
for one second?
Because this is such an important point. The particularly libelous piece of this is the suggestion that Israel is somehow indifferent to this. What you've just described is obviously they are assiduously focused on reducing civilian casualties to the point where they've done a better job of it than Americans, for example, in places like Fallujah.
Than any army in history. You know, and of course, if one asks the simple question, like, does Israel gain more by killing civilians or not killing civilians? Obviously, they gain more by protecting them. They don't need this isolation on the diplomatic world stage. But if we just probe a little bit deeper, Frank, if we ask ourselves the question, assuming that the U.S. administration, that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and all these folks in Washington know this, they must know it to be true. They can read John Spencer's article in Newsweek just like I can. And they could do the math themselves about how many Hamas fighters have been killed versus how many civilians have purportedly been killed, even if we take that number at face value. Considering the fact that they know this, one has to ask, okay, why are they claiming that the civilian casualty number has been excessively high, and then using that as a pretext to call for a different plan and for a joint operation and for the U.S. to have boots on the ground? And this extends also to the whole issue of this port or floating pier, that they have to bring in more humanitarian aid, even though, even according to the World Food Program numbers, the amount of food that Gazans need and how much food has been brought in, there is an excessive amount of food in the Gaza Strip right now. Maybe it was all commandeered by Hamas, which this pier won't solve. But one has to ask, why are they doing this? And unfortunately, the unmistakable conclusion we have to draw, unless you have a better theory, Frank, is that the United States wants to create a military foothold in the area. And as I've been saying since October 7th, Frank, and you've heard me say it over and over again, this United States administration does not want Israel to destroy Hamas. And that's why they brought the Qataris in. The Qataris have invested tens of billions of dollars in building up Hamas. The United States is bringing the Qataris more and more into the picture here because they don't want Israel destroying Hamas. And that is the dispute.
Which will bring us back to that port in just a moment. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back with Rabbi Pesach Wilicki of Israel, a man that I admire greatly, but also have as a dear friend. And we're going to talk with him about the other mistakes this administration, Biden administration, is making that seems aimed at saving Hamas. Stay tuned. We're back, and we are visiting with Rabbi Pesach Walicki. He is the host of his own television program on Real America's Voice entitled Eyes on Israel. He is also an extraordinarily, prodigiously productive advocate for Israel, but also champion of, I think, the truth in the face of a lot of disinformation, misinformation, malinformation, and the like, not least of it coming from the Biden administration, it would appear. And Rabbi, we were talking about this, well, slander against Israel, that it's indifferent to civilian casualties and therefore needs to be constrained from, for example, going into Rafah and rooting out the last, we're told, 3,000 Palestinian terrorists there, Hamas and presumably others. But there's also this libel that Israel is somehow starving the people of Gaza en masse. You know, babies withering away is a favorite refrain of the BBC and others in their reporting there, based on UN findings, no less. Give us the straight poop on what's going on with respect to the food. You've said there's plenty of it. Some of it's being commandeered by Hamas. Can you give us some sense of just how much and to what end?
Yeah, thank you for asking about this. This is, you know, this gets to the heart of, like I said, the blood libel of it. Kamala Harris a week or two ago talked about how Gazans are starving, and everyone's talking about how there's this impending starvation going on. It's demonstrably false. Let me just share with you from the World Food Program, which is a UN program. According to the World Food Program, Gaza needs 4,000 tons of food per week. 4,000 tons of food per week. That's how much they need. According to the UN, every number I'm going to give you here is from the UN themselves. Okay.
Which is not generally known to be terribly favorably disposed towards Israel. I think that's
correct. The UN is. Other than voting to create the state of Israel in 1948, ever since then, it's been anti-Israel nonstop. Yeah, and the question is, as to why that is a question for sociologists or theologians. But the fact is that Israel does not get a fair hearing in the UN. But this is just the UN's numbers. According to the UN, Gaza needs 4,000 tons of food per week. In the 25 weeks or so since October 7th, there have been imported in humanitarian aid through these trucks that come in 250,000 tons of food, which would mean that they have 10,000 tons of food per week, which is more than twice what the UN claims is needed. You also have claims going around in media that before October 7th, there were 500 trucks of food going in every day, and now there's only around 200. This is false. Again, you could look up the numbers in the UN website. There were over 200 trucks going in before October 7th, and most of them were not food. They were construction supplies and industrial supplies. A small percentage of them were food. Even if you account for the lack of food production since the war started, the fact that there are over 200 trucks per day going in. Look, we could get into the weeds, Frank. The bottom line is there's plenty of food there. The problem is, and there could be some Gazans who are deprived of food, but the problem is that the food is handed into the hands of Hamas. And with this pier, the United States seeking to solve this problem by creating a pier, a little port, a floating pier, that they're going to bring in more humanitarian aid. And what's the pretext of that? Or the subtext of that? The premise is that Israel's not doing enough. So that's really what this is about. The United States must know these numbers. They're not fools. Frank, anytime we think that our adversaries are fools, we end up missing what they're really doing. So axiom number one is we have to assume that they know the information, that they know the truth. They know this. They're not fools. They know that there's more than enough food going in there. It's being commandeered by Hamas, which means it's being used as leverage over the people in all the ways that the terrorists do. And the United States is demonizing Israel with this canard.
They are, and they are helping to save Hamas with this
war. That's what it's all about.
I really think this is an effort, among other things, to create facts on the ground that give rise to the two-state solution, so-called, that they are insisting upon, the United States government under President Biden. You know, I did want to make just a quick comment on all of this, Pesach. As you know, back just about 30 years ago, our Center for Security Policy did a very important report about the idea of putting American forces into the struggles that Israel has with its adversaries of various kinds. At the time, this was about the idea of putting American forces on the Golan Heights as part of a process that would turn back those heights to Syria. Fortunately, in part, I think, as a result of the excellent work of the Center for Security Policy, and I hope you will all support that work at centerforsecuritypolicy.org, we were able to, you know, buy time, and the thing came a cropper, notably when Yitzhak Rabin, one of its the authors of this plan, was assassinated tragically. But, you know, it reminds me of that report and the arguments that we don't want American forces or, you know, personnel more generally anywhere near these things, let alone running a port or otherwise helping build one out, to say nothing of having a command center in Rafah, for heaven's sakes. It looked at from the Israeli perspective, which has historically, as you know so well, Pesach, you say you've got children in the fight right now. You don't want anybody else fighting those fights, as I understand it. Has that changed, or is this a gambit on the administration's part to try to force a change that would not be in Israel's interest?
That has not changed at all. If we just go back to the C.Q. Brown idea of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs saying that he has a plan for Rafah, when this was released to the Israeli media today, I was just, you know, before we went into the studio to have this conversation, I was taking a look at how it's being reported in Hebrew. And what the talkbacks are like and what people are saying about it. And let me just put it bluntly, it's not being well received by Israelis. The last thing, and remember, let's remember that Israel's a citizen army. It's not just me, it's every family. We are, news about the military is news about us as a nation. And Israelis have no appetite for anyone having boots on the ground fighting our battles for us. And that's why I welcome any of your viewers could go online, and it's readily available where you can see where there are American bases all over the world. And you'll see American bases in every country in the Middle East except Israel.
Right. And rightly so. We need to keep it that way. We strongly support Israel, of course, but we don't want American forces in the mix, which I think would be
they'll be targeted by these jihadists
to your interest and ours. Sure. We've got to let you go, Rabbi. We'll have you back to talk more about this port in the near future, I hope, among other things. Thank you for your time today. Thank you for the great work you do at Israel 365 News. Check it out, folks. Thanks to all of you for joining us. Come back next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.